Investors Chronicle.
Companies and Markets show on the docket today. Sainsbury's is our result of the week. Alex Newman talks through his latest long read on the lessons to be learned from the world's greatest investor, aka Warren Buffett. And new IC writer Mitchell Labiak joins us to talk about the quote-unquote warehouse bubble. All that and more, let's get going. Welcome, welcome, listener. Nice to have you with us again. Thursday, 5th of May, as we record. Some important housekeeping before we get going, because we're delighted to announce that we've made a new signing on the pod. IC Deputy Editor Dan Jones has joined the pod for a checks, notes, undisclosed fee, and will be sharing hosting duties with myself. Glad to have you on board, Dan. Medical pass, contract signed, debut is all that's left.
Raring to go. Thank you for having me.
Well, break a leg to mix my metaphors. Also on the panel this week, Julian Hoffman. Hello.
Hello there, everyone.
Hiya, hiya. And another first-timer, new IC writer, Mitchell Labiak.
Hello. Hello. Hello, listeners.
What's your sort of beat, Mitch?
My beat is the property sector, so all things commercial and residential property. That's my bag.
Lovely. And we'll be getting into some warehouses a bit later.
That's my jam.
That's the jam. Sure. Lovely stuff. Alex Newman also joining us a little later. Quick news roundup before we get on with the pod. So some selected companies updates for the week, a few fashion lines. Tears for Boohoo as profits dropped after a year of high freight costs, subdued demand and customer returns. The group has reported a 94% fall in statutory pre-tax profit, despite revenue rising by 13%. Meanwhile, Jewel's shares slipped by 36%, landing at an all-time low after announcing a double whammy of a profit warning and the departure of Chief Executive Nick Jones. From brogues to beers, sales at JD Wetherspoons exceeded pre-pandemic levels at the end of its latest quarter. And Chair Tim Martin said the company would break even this financial year after heavy losses during the pandemic. And from beers to barrels, BP has both increased its buyback programme and given the UK government a forecast local spend out to 2030 of £18 billion. Meanwhile, Shell has tripled its March quarter adjusted profits, and also looks set to increase its buyback volume later in the year. Oil majors' continued record profits have led to more chatter about a one-off windfall tax, though so far Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng has contented himself with writing to oil bosses to insist profits are reinvested in the UK. We've got lots more company stuff on the IC website, and I should also flag up our daily trader email that gets all of these updates sent straight into your inbox. It's free of charge. Details will be in the podcast description. In other news, Fed Up, that's not Alex Newman after writing 3,000 words on Warren Buffett last weekend, but the latest central bank movements, a 50 BPS interest rates rise in the US from the Fed yesterday, with the Bank of England following suit and a 25 basis point increase. And finally, some gossip. A mini feud between Elon Musk and Bill Gates has been a brewing. Last week, Musk accused Gates of, quote, shorting Tesla while claiming to support climate change action. This morning, in an interview with the BBC, Gates claimed any Tesla bets have nothing to do with climate change, did not deny he was shorting the company, and was a bit cagey about Musk's potential impact on Twitter. It's not exactly Arlie versus Fraser, but something to keep an eye on. That's all from me, all from our news roundup. Over to you, Dan.
Thanks very much, John. So, yeah, we're going to start the rest of the podcast with our result of the week, as is traditional. This week, we're looking at Sainsbury's, ever topical, particularly right now, of course, coming off the back of interest rate rise and the Bank of England's inflation report talking about pressures on the UK economy. Obviously, Sainsbury's had a very good 2021 following Tesco reporting a bumper set of results. But the big focus is really on how it's going to manage the challenges of this year, balancing rising input costs with price wars, really, and uncertain consumer demand. I think there's also some questions over the challenges Sainsbury's in particular faces in comparison to the likes of Tesco and the discounters on the other hand as well. Julian, you covered the results for us this week. What was your kind of take, sort of overall take on Sainsbury's performance and its outlook as well?
Oh, yeah, thanks, Dan. Well, yes, it was my great pleasure to cover Sainsbury's. I'm old enough to and have worked long enough in journalism to remember when the Qataris were going to buy this for 580 a share back in 2007. It's fair to say that shareholders won't be looking at anything near that, like that return. The results themselves weren't bad on a sort of line by line basis. They were okay. So the main thing that people took away was that the company hasn't given back the performance that it generated during the pandemic. So basically, sales and everything are flat, which means that as the costs of the extraordinary costs that the pandemic imposed fall away, there is a sort of a measure of profit that it's managed to hold on to. So that's a kind of positive thing. Traditionally, the big grocers also benefit from price hikes or price input inflation. They can generally hand that on. And the other thing to note in the sector as well, that there doesn't seem to be much sign of the sort of discount wars that plague the companies in the sort of 2000s and 2010s, even though the discounters like Lidl and Aldi are definitely a threat to everyone's sort of bottom line. But the main thing that we took away from it is that they're kind of performing okay on an operational level, but they do have some sort of deeper issues once you start to look at the balance sheet in more depth. And what I did was to look at what they're investing in the business as opposed to what the value is depreciating slowly out of it. And that ratio is still hovering around 50%. So they're essentially about half of their business is depreciating away. It has to do that because they're very close to their covenants in terms of the amount of debt they can carry. So they have to deleverage now in order to bring that under control. It's a catch-22 situation. You won't notice it, I don't think, in the shops, in that the light bulbs will get changed and the painting will be done. But it's how much it takes away from the long-term prospects of the business. And I don't think personally that they can run that for much longer. I think they're going to have to start investing in the business. And actually, next year they're forecasting that they'll put about 700 million to 750 million back into it versus a depreciation rate of about 1.2 billion. So there's definitely a huge gap. So I also noted in the article that if you look at the comparison for Tesco runs about 1.2 billion in investment versus about 1.4 billion in depreciation. So there's definitely a very big gap there.
I think you mentioned catch 22 situation, and that probably applies in more ways than one. Obviously, the balance sheet is a big medium-term issue. In the short term, as you touched on, you've got this balance between wanting to maintain margins, wanting to maintain market share, but equally you don't want to have a situation where you're forced to raise prices far too high. But despite the fact input costs are really going up as well, it seems to me that, as you say, there's not necessarily that much sign of a price war yet, but there's perhaps some rumblings. And if you're Sainsbury's and Tesco's, you want to avoid the mistakes of a few years back when they effectively allowed the discounters to really eat into that market share by not competing on price. And therefore, that means right now they've got to wear these high costs and keep prices low at the same time.
It's essentially they could just about carry it. I mean, the one area that was a big deal, I think that came out a few months ago when Asda was taken over, was that the people who own Asda were not going to compete on fuel prices. I think a lot of people took that as a sign that there is an unofficial truce about pricing wars. And indeed, you can sort of see that that's rolled out across all of the supermarkets. So, I mean, if you go to your local garage now, the price is more or less the same as you would find at the local supermarket. And in fact, down the road, the local petrol station near where I live, and this being Devon, it also sells a variety of tractor parts. The price of the petrol is exactly the same as if you drive 12 miles to the nearest Sainsbury's or Tesco. And that is a sign, I would take that as a sign that they're going to keep margins up in one area, and that might allow them a little bit of leeway in terms of cutting their core prices or their core offering. But they just don't have a lot of wiggle room at the same time as carrying far more costs than you would find at your average Lidl or Aldi. And I think that's just a structural problem. But Sainsbury's fundamentally is a very well-known and great brand in that it still attracts the kind of middle England shopper that regards Tesco's as a bit down market, but can't really afford to shop at Waitrose every week. So it's got a niche. It's just really a case of whether they can power through the next couple of years and rebuild the strength of the balance sheet by deleveraging and at the same time not allowing the business to depreciate in such a way that it becomes irrecoverable. But I think we're a long way from anyone wanting to buy it on a, you know, it's cheap, but it also needs an awful lot of investment if you were to buy it.
Just on that note, obviously Tesco, relatively cheap as well, a little bit more expensive, which probably reflects, you know, obviously all supermarkets have had a good couple of years. The tailwinds are well known, but Tesco has really sort of grown its market share a little bit. And probably isn't dogged by the same operational issues, it seems to me, as Sainsbury's is. Is that a fair kind of comparison? And
Yeah, I mean, Sainsbury's has been a basket case in many ways for a long time. So it's not, that isn't, in a sense on its own, that isn't a surprise. You know, Tesco seems to have sorted out their act a bit quicker after the sort of day, after the accounting and supplier pricing scandals that they had. It can sort of exist as it is for quite a long time, but the question then becomes, well, where do you get the value out of it? I think that's, is it worth the value? Is the discount reflective really of its sort of diminished status, or is there a possibility that it might recover to the average for the sector? I mean, that's really where we are, really.
You mentioned the Qataris, a long time ago now, 15 years almost, I suppose. But the bid speculation has always been there with Sainsbury's, particularly in the last year, given what we saw with Morrisons and Asda as well. That's kind of faded away a bit this year. No bid was forthcoming. How do you sort of see that perennial kind of question hanging over Sainsbury's?
The problem is, if you're going to bid for the company, you're not just buying the value of the company. You're buying a company where the debt is almost the same as level as the market capitalization. I don't know whether they'd be interested in it at the moment. I think they need to leverage it a bit more, and then you might see a private equity player come in. I mean, it's a difficult one. You wonder if it's at the stage where it's no price is too cheap for it. I think that's that all prices are too expensive, no matter how cheap they actually are on paper.
Yeah, I think it remains a wait and see, as it has done for some time.
Well, the last 15 years, basically.
Exactly, yeah. On the subject of deal making, something a bit more concrete, someone who has been making deals again and making purchases is Warren Buffett, who is the subject of our cover feature this week, which appropriately timed given the Berkshire Hathaway AGM last weekend. That was the first in-person AGM for a couple of years. And that was also quite well timed. I'm sure Buffett and Co. will consider that to be the case, given the way their performance has really rebounded. Their returns have really accelerated again over the past year. The drivers for that, to a certain extent, are quite obvious. You know, we've seen a shift away from some of the growthier parts of the market, given the rising inflation, rising rates in the US. Alex Newman today wrote the cover feature. Looking at Buffett and his style and what we can learn from him and you know, various thoughts to that end. Alex, why don't we sort of start by just, I suppose, summing up what's changed, or perhaps what's driven Buffett's return to form in the past few years again?
So I suppose the context is the last few years of Berkshire performance. I mean, they lagged the S&P, actually did quite well against the index post-financial crash, but they were really in the shade, you know, in the slightly delirious run in US equity markets after the COVID crash. So, I mean, that was really completely to be expected because Berkshire didn't have the concentration of so-called pandemic winners and tech stocks that the index had. So it was always going to suffer by that rather heady comparison. But at the same time, you know, there are a few people who doubted his conviction and, you know, whether he still had the magic touch. So he made a pretty bad bet, and a pretty large one as well, on a company called Precision Cast Parts, which required a big write down in the sort of the eye of the storm of the pandemic. He had another bad bet on airlines that went awry, and before that there was the failed backing for Kraft's takeover of Unilever. But I mean, net-net, it was kind of just fairly stodgy US equity market growth over the last decade. So to bring it up to speed, as you said, I mean, he has kind of emerged from the shade of this all-conquering US equity, tech-led equity story, because He's built a portfolio of companies and of stocks that that is much better at weathering a high interest, high inflation environment. And that's been borne out by the relative performance. I think it's something like 17% compared to the S&P over the last year. But on almost any time frame over the last 20 years now, he is ahead. So yeah, that's the context to Buffett's bounce back or whatever pithy phrasing, which I'm glad you guys didn't run with.
Well, in the end, we went with an interesting, I think, graffiti angle. Yeah, really capping his kind of return to form, which, as you say, is relatively short term, but you know, he's got the backing of multi decade success as well. As I mentioned, you know, he's been active again, buying, topping up on a lot of holdings, making some new purchases as well. Maybe if we want to talk about them a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about it in the last few weeks as well. I mean, Julian covered a few weeks ago. He bought a kind of a Berkshire-like insurance to toy manufacturing conglomerate called Allegheny for $11 billion, which he has admired for a long time. He has bought into HP, which is a kind of classic Warren Buffett, slightly boring industrial style, cash-generating, kind of annoying company almost, you know, the printer cartridges, people need them. They, you know, they're not necessarily innovating there, but it's a reliable cash generator and a product that people need. But yeah, like you said, I mean, he's been topping up his holdings. He even topped up some of his enormous Apple stake in the first quarter. He's sort of doubled down on the oil and gas bet that he's been quite bullish about over the last couple of years. I mean, you can read a few things into him going back into the market, but I mean, for me, I think the most important thing it shows is that, you know, there's this need to put capital to work, because his enormous cash pile is in real terms being eroded away quite quickly by the level of inflation we have. So he's not only gone big into US equities in the last few months, but also doubled down on US treasuries. And then at the same time, there is this just US consumer play, which he's built his entire career on. So yeah, those are some of the themes.
Buffett has probably explicitly said, I'm sure, in the past, you know, he'd hate to be, you know, he would not want to be termed and does not see himself as a macro investor, but it's still quite hard not to see this kind of purchase as, you know, vote of confidence in the US economy. All right, he's got his cash pile that, yeah, you know, needs to be used, but equally, you know, he's backing these businesses and they're coming from a range of different, I suppose it just shows the diversity of, you know, the US market, that he can put all this money to work at a time when a lot of other parts of the market are really struggling.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, he makes that point often that, you know, they don't like to take a macro picture, but obviously that feeds into any of their capital allocation decisions. But I suppose his spin on it is that it's always business focused. So he's always thinking about the return on capital that a business can make rather than the valuations of the market as a whole. You know, that is where arguably in moments like this, where stock picking expertise comes into its own rather than just buying the market. So yeah, I mean, well, that was, you know, they talked about inflation. I sat through a couple of hours of the mammoth AGM on Saturday, and that was one of the, I mean, inflation came up a great deal. So, you know, it's on their minds, however way they present it.
And from the UK investors' point of view, you know, looking perhaps a bit more closely at this style again right now, given, you know, the inflation worries we all know about, I suppose they have two choices, really, as we touch on in the piece. You know, obviously Berkshire itself is, you know, accessible, but equally, you know, there are some parallels with its holdings and the makeup of the FTSE 100, really. So
yeah. I mean, the A shares aren't that accessible unless you have $500,000. You can obviously buy the fractional B shares, but yeah, I mean, in terms of comparison, and you know, no financial advice given here, there is a distinction, I suppose, even though the kind of companies he backs have some parallels with the mature, stodgy UK blue chips, which dominate the FTSE 100. I mean, he's still backing the US economy, which, as opposed to a UK/multinational flavor that the FTSE 100 has. And yeah, I mean, if I was forced to choose which horse to back, I mean, I think the track record shows that the US economy, you know, for all its problems and, you know, longer term, that is, it's hard to see that underperforming UK, Europe, rest of world.
There we go.
Yeah, he may not be around for the next 70 years.
Well, we'll come to that shortly, because I'm sure he won't be, even by his standards of longevity. Julian, I just want to maybe get your thoughts on Buffett, on his investment style. You know, you look at some US portfolios for the IC. What's your kind of take on his position?
Yeah, his longevity is amazing. I think he started investing just before the start of the Boer War. But it kind of plays to what he's interested in, really. And it isn't just valuation grounds, I don't think. I mean, I think he's essentially goes for companies that have a lot of market share in a very particular area. So the exception to that would be Allegheny. But I think we drew the conclusion that was partly an inflation play. So Buffett's buying into the conglomerate model. I think that's how we would best describe it. So, if you could remember investing in the 60s and 70s, if you look back at the history of it, conglomerates started appearing because they were a reaction to insidious kind of inflation problems. So there is Alex touched on it, as much as he kind of denies it, he is actually buying a macro theme. I think that's the conclusion we could draw from it. And the type of companies he buys, that they all have pricing power in them, I think. And that's the other defining feature of all of his investments, that they seem to be able to match what they can charge to what the current cost of doing business is. So, insurers are a very good example of that. If you're a specialist manufacturer of, Allegheny also makes gravestones for American cemeteries. Yeah. That's never going to go out of business. I think, an emerging sense that he's playing the wider trends. I don't think that they, on their own, that's just a stock picking choice that he's making.
Yeah, I would say the one caveat here is the oil and gas thing, because I mean he likes to buy businesses for a very long term, and the oil and gas earnings we've seen, like from Shell's results this morning, they're absolutely in the ascendant. They're making buckets of money, but it doesn't really seem in keeping, given the regulatory and climate obstacles which are face those companies are pretty profound on a kind of 10-year basis, if not sooner. So I think that is an interesting play. That seems a much more trader like approach he's taken there. But yeah, I mean, like, Chevron's still going to be around in 10 years in America, so
long term. Yeah, as you say, as a man in his 90s, I mean, there's a degree of
that's a good point.
We've got to move on, but it is quite interesting, I think, that that conglomerate point, that what happens after Buffett goes. 6 months ago it seemed like the conglomerate was a thing of the past. You had that week where Toshiba, Johnson & Johnson, GE all said they were going to split up. Now, again, inflation concerns to the fore, and Buffett's buys makes you think maybe they've got a bit more life in them after all. But the question for Berkshire will be, after he goes, will there be more calls to split it up? So I suppose we'll just have to wait and see when that fated day comes. But yeah, we are going to move on just for time purposes. This is a story actually that was in last week's IC, written by Mitchell, our new property writer, and it proved quite auspicious, I think.
I'd love to be able to say that I predicted Amazon's profit warning, and that's why I wrote this 1,300-word feature. But I mean, really, you could have that you could have published that feature 6 months ago, and it would, the same warning signs would have been there. It just so happens that Amazon's profit warning has come up. So,
just to to give a bit of context, this is the feature on warehouses and warehouse REIT, Tritax, Big Box, that kind of thing. Looking at, obviously they've had a fantastic amount of interest over the past few years. Looking at, whether that interest is effectively, starting to bubble over. And then, a couple of days after that piece was published, we had Amazon said that it had overextended itself in terms of its own warehouse capacity for obvious reasons, to an extent, given the sort of outsized demand you saw during the pandemic, but that it was now scaling back. And obviously you've seen a fall in some of these valuations over the past few days for the likes of Tritax, that kind of thing, on the back of that comment from Amazon.
Yeah, we have. Although, it's important not to sort of overstate it, because some of those shares have since recovered a little bit. But I think it was a sign that, yeah, all is not completely rosy. I don't think the bubble has burst or anything, but I think, you know, more people are asking the question about deflated was a word I saw someone else, another property commentator, use sort of, yeah, the bubble's kind of deflating a little bit. People realizing that the market won't, you know, the party can't last forever. You know, you can't keep building warehouses at the level to which we've been building them for the past few years and expect those warehouses to be leased all of the time.
Yeah. I think as you say, it shows maybe what's happening in a lot of sectors. You know, the price for perfection, you know, it just takes a little thing. Okay, Amazon is a big tenant, big driver, but you know, it takes one comment to wipe, you know, a decent amount off in a few days. Okay, prices today, this morning has been a bit of a rebound, but there's, yeah, you know, people are starting to reconsider almost all their positions now in this kind of environment.
Yeah, it's a really difficult one to predict. So on the one hand, of course, Amazon is a big player. It's 25% of, it was 25% of the UK market last year, and it was 24% the year before that, or something thereabouts. The warning signs are already there in a way, because the data we refer to in our piece, they were 3% of the market. When I say the market, I mean newly leased space. So take up, as it's referred to by property types, property nerds like myself. But they were, yeah, they were 24, 25% of take up the last couple of years, and they were 3% this first quarter. So they've already been slowing down. The profit warning indicates they're going to arguably slow down further. I suppose the reason why it's... why some people are reading more into it than just Amazon, reading the whole market into it, is aside from the fact that Amazon's, you know, a huge tenant, it's presumably the same pressures that Amazon are under as an e-commerce company, other large e-commerce companies are also under. And if it's not Amazon, you know, Amazon is 25% of the market, but e-commerce as a whole is most of the market. Like this is why the warehouse sector has boomed. It's been driven by a rise in online shopping. And if someone like Amazon says, well, we actually need less space than we first anticipated to service that demand, or we need less new space than anticipated to service that demand for online shopping, presumably that will be a very similar situation for other companies. So this is why these big warehouse developers are taking a hit. But they're still, you know, I think Tritax, you know, in the same, almost the day after its share price dropped, it was able to put out a result saying that it's had the biggest, I think it said the biggest Q1 on record for new take up, and a 100% increase on the year before. So it's not like the wheels have come off. But it is, it's certainly, it raises questions about sort of the sheer amount of speculative development, I suppose, that's going on.
Yeah. I think, as you point out in the piece, there's plenty of tailwinds still there.
Mm.
One which really reminded me, this whole scenario of, you know, when you look at elevated valuations, how long can it go? Until this year, you know, you had a similar kind of question hanging over government debt, UK gilts for many years, but one parallel was, you know, there was a structural buyer really in the shape of pension funds and overseas investors looking for safe assets. And you touch on in your piece, you know, the foreign investor interest in this asset class is still really strong, which should provide, you know, there's a certain degree of price insensitivity there even.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the people I spoke to was for the piece was essentially saying that it's just a place to put your money. It's, you know, it's still, warehouses are still the safest bet in real estate, probably, in terms of an asset class. They're still a safe place to put your money. But I think it's the assumption that every bet on warehousing is a good bet, or that any amount of money is a decent amount of money to pay, that I think is should have been questioned 6 months ago, but is definitely being questioned now. So it's, yeah, I think it's still a sensible investment. It's a question of how much money, though. I think that's the, you know, with investment yields decreasing to 3.25%, which is the lowest figure on record, the question was always going to be they can't keep decreasing forever, and the amount of money being invested into these warehouse assets can't keep increasing forever. There has to be a point where that sort of, at the very least, levels off.
Especially as yields elsewhere are finally starting to rise a little bit. Mm. Alex, you obviously were a property coverage, were the property correspondent for a long time. Do you kind of agree with that assessment? How do you see the market?
Yeah. I mean, totally. I mean, Mitch will cover the big points there. I suppose the thing that you'd always hear from the warehouse landlords is the how small a portion that the rental costs may actually make up for the tenant. So it's single digit often, isn't it? That they're, depending on the scale of
yeah, it can be. Although this is. I mean, I'll let you make your point. But
no. I was going to say, and on that basis, they're. Hence all the bullish projections. We can raise, we can raise rents year after year after year, open market rent reviews. It's kind of going to be rosy, but it's rosy until it isn't.
It's rosy until it isn't. And it's not the case. Absolutely. I've heard, because I speak to many warehouse developers in my previous role and also in this role, I speak to a lot of warehouse developers and they say the same thing. It's only a fraction of their overall cost of doing business. But there are instances where Paul Weston in the piece pointed to, they had a tenant who was in a certain prime logistics location in London and they had to move out because they couldn't afford the rent. Now that's an exception. That is an exceptionally high level of warehousing rent. But the point is it does happen. So I think it's not good enough really, I suppose, for warehouse developers to sort of wave that concern aside and say, oh, actually the rental costs aren't a big part of doing business. I think for some smaller players they are, and so we can't keep it. It is a question people have, which is, well, yes, the supply and demand dynamics, vacancy rate still being at a record low, the amount of empty warehouse space is still at a record low, take up is still at a record high. The supply and demand dynamics would imply that rents have to keep increasing, but there comes a point where some companies just can't pay that. So you have to that has to be factored in at some point, as much as warehouse developers would like not to factor that in, because all of the other metrics are showing that they can increase rent and they can build based on the assumption of that increased rent. But it's not always the case.
And it's a really good point. And you look at Amazon. I mean, we think of them in kind of they're a sort of behemoth. They have such a huge position that you can sometimes forget their margins are wafer thin as well. That actually they make them a point where they have less wriggle room when it comes to rents, and also they have this huge position where in some of the mega boxes, I mean, what kind of replacement tenant is a landlord going to find if you get to a kind of crunch talk point? If we have a big recession and they're coming up to their market rent review, suddenly the tables turn a bit.
Yeah, it's a difficult one. And I think it is at that point, it's important to differentiate between sort of speculative development and what's known as build to suit. So a lot of the safer developers, like, arguably your Segros and your Prologis's will do build a lot more build to suit development. So they'll build something. They've already got a tenant lined up. The tenant has already said they're going to take it for 20 years. That's 20 years of income sort of sorted. Where you get a bit more danger is where a lot of speculative development happens. This is obviously where the margins are bigger and the potential for, reward is higher, but the risk is higher as well. This is developing a warehouse without having a tenant, hoping that maybe Amazon or someone like Amazon will take it, and hoping that they'll pay not the rent as it is now, but the rent as it will be by the time the warehouse finishes. And the problem with the market at the moment is too much of this happening. Once again, on the tailwind side, the warehouse developers will still point to the fact that even with that speculative development happening and even with Amazon taking less space, vacancy rate is around 1.2%, which is the lowest it's ever been. And to give you an idea of when the market was in the real doldrums, in 2008, it was around 10%. So we'd have to have take up completely fall off a cliff and speculative development go wild for the market to be in real trouble. But it is certainly it's a decent health check, I think, Amazon's profit warning, and an argument that, the party can't last forever. So maybe we might see the market cool off rather than a bubble burst, I suppose.
Yeah, I think, as you say, the Amazon's certainly not going anywhere. Neither are its. I drove past its Milton Keynes warehouse the other day for the first time, actually. It takes about 5 minutes to drive past, doesn't it? It's so big. But plenty of food for thought there. Plenty of food for thought, I think, for the whole market at the moment, really. As today's discussion showed, there's a lot of interesting conversations going on when perhaps the tide starts to go out in some areas. So that's all we've got time for. Thank you very much to Mitchell, to Alex and to Julian. And thank you to the listeners for tuning in. And we will speak to you again next week.
The Companies and Markets Show was edited and produced by me, John Rogers. And if you've liked what you heard, please do head on over to the iTunes store and give us a rating and review. We'd love to hear some of your feedback.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.